Unstoppable Sound Agency.
Welcome to this edition of Move to Amend Reports, where we connect you with activists and organizers working on the front lines of the democracy movement to bring you the lowdown on corporate rule, corporate personhood, and money as speech. This is the space to find info you need to help pass the We the People Amendment and legalize democracy. I'm Egberto Willis, and
I'm Laura Barnum. Bill Fletcher Jr. was involved in activism as early as high school and carries that torch today as an internationally recognized racial justice and labor activist. After graduating from Harvard, Fletcher took a job as a shipyard welder as a way into the labor movement. There he became involved in issues such as union democracy, health and safety, and racial justice. Fletcher involved himself in the desegregation of the building trades in Boston and later was a staff member in various unions, including District 65 United Auto Workers, the Service Employees International Union, the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, and the National AFL-CIO. Fletcher served as education director for the AFL-CIO and eventually assistant to the president. A visiting professor at Brooklyn College, CUNY, Fletcher was also president of TransAfrica Forum, a nonprofit advocacy research and education center focused on justice for the African world. During his prolific writing career, Fletcher co-authored The Indispensable Ally, Black Workers and the Formation of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, 1934 through 1921, and Solidarity Divided. His most recent book, They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. Welcome to the show, Bill Fletcher Jr.
Oh, I'm really glad to be here. Thank you.
Our mission at Move to Amend is to make real the promise of American democracy to extend civil, economic, and environmental rights to every person in an authentic, participatory, and representative government that serves we the people equally, not just corporations and the 1% who control them. To that end, we are very actively involved in building a democracy movement, which is hard work and only made harder in a presidential election year. So please discuss the differences between campaigns and movements and compare and contrast the 1998 Jesse Jackson push coalition, you know, the Rainbow Push Coalition campaign to the current Bernie Sanders campaign, which he's calling the revolution.
So this question could keep us going for several hours because it is that fundamental. So a campaign is a time-limited initiative that usually has one particular target. If it's an election campaign, it's obviously to get the candidate elected. If it's an issue campaign, it's to win on that issue. A movement, by definition, has multiple objectives and general goals. So, for example, when people talk about the Civil Rights Movement did not have just one objective. It actually had multiple objectives of ending Jim Crow segregation, of securing voting rights, of starting to build the rudiments of Black political power, of helping to catalyze other social movements for democracy. And so that's the big difference between a campaign and a movement. Now, the thing about the Jackson campaign of 1988 and the Sanders campaign is that they share a number of things in common, but they are also quite distinct. The Jackson campaign of 1988, in many ways, was the result of several different factors that came together. One of the most important being the black-led electoral upsurge. It starts in the late 1970s, early 1980s, in the fight for political power at the city level, the rise of black mayors, et cetera. The second factor was Reaganism, Reagan and Reaganism. And in response to the Reagan presidency, there was a dramatic amount of capitulation. There were certain exceptions, the anti-nuclear movement, both nuclear anti-nuclear power as well as anti-nuclear war, and some others did respond. The Black Freedom Movement, in many ways, challenged Reaganism, and Jackson came to epitomize that. But Jackson went beyond that, and one of the reasons that I have cited the Jackson campaign in some of my criticisms of the Sanders campaign is that Jackson created an overall narrative that was very interesting and very compelling. He had a narrative about what had happened to the United States, not just what had happened to Black America, but what had happened to the United States. And in that narrative, issues of race and gender were very, very important and in some ways unprecedented in mainstream electoral politics. He was able to talk to various constituencies and link their issues to this overall narrative. As I like to say, he could go into Kansas and talk to white farmers and link the fight that they were having to save the family farm to what was happening to workers generally, what was happening to Black America, et cetera. So his narrative was not simply slogans. It really was a story. And it was a story about how regular people were being crushed as the economic system was altering. The problem in the Sanders campaign is that one of the problems is that the narrative that the senator has laid out is, at least it has been, fairly narrow. It is focused largely on economic inequality. The polarization of wealth, political corruption, all of which are very, very important. The problem is that the other components of what should be a generalized narrative end up sounding like or feeling like add-ons, as opposed to being integral components of his narrative. And this is a very big strategic as well as communications problem that they've had great deal of difficulty with. And it plays itself out when, for example, people will say, you know, you can ask Sanders anything and it will return to the issue of economic inequality or polarization of wealth. Now, that may sound good. And if you're doing certain kinds of interviews with the media, you want to convey a particular message. But what you also want is you want your supporters and potential supporters to see in you and to hear in your message their story, not as an add-on, but as a central component.
That makes a lot of sense when you make mention about you. Actually, I think it is something if you read I don't remember the name of the book on how you speak to people. And that is, in effect, one of the flaws I see in that particular campaign, that you don't centralize around the group that you're talking about, tailoring the message appropriately. So that is, in effect, an issue that needs to be addressed. Now, some have compared Sanders' campaign to the Eugene Debs campaign. What's your perspective on that?
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting campaign comparison because Eugene Debs is an iconic figure on the left and in U.S. history, for that matter, and is a critical image for Senator Sanders. And so I think in some respects, there is a comparison to be made.
in both cases, there has been an attempt in the case of Sanders and was an attempt in the case of Debs to really mount a challenge against the extremes of capitalism and to speak to working people. Eugene Debs was able to do that, even though he obviously did not win. He was able to build a substantial following. In both cases, the Socialist Party of that period, 1912, and to a great extent Eugene Debs and Sanders, fall into the category of the rising tide raises all boats theory of change. And it's a very common theory within the United States in segments of the left and progressive movements. And it's pretty straightforward. The basic idea being that to the extent that we identify significant economic reforms, that whether it's healthcare, education, or whatever, that in introducing these reforms and winning these reforms, first of all, we can unite broad strata of the society around these demands. The demands are not divisive. And the second part is that the nature of these demands will raise the level of even the most impoverished of the population and thereby address racist oppression. That's a theory. Now, the problem is the theory is flawed, and it has always been flawed. There is no historical foundation for that. While it is true that there are major economic advances that have happened, for example, the New Deal in the 30s, that assisted many segments of Black America, of Chicanos, etc., what it did not do, what those kind of reforms do not do, is that they do not address in a direct way the racial differential that exists in the treatment of whites compared to most non-whites. And so in both the case of Sanders and in Debs, there has been this sort of hope that by addressing these common economic issues, that we can all come together, we can all unify. The populist movement of the late 1800s and 1890s very much held such a view very strongly, but was absolutely not able to withstand the white supremacist counter-revolution that swept the South. And in fact, many white populists ended up turning on their Black allies, blaming their Black allies for any host of things and making common cause with white supremacist politicians. George Wallace, the former governor of Alabama, when he was elected in the 1950s, saw himself as a populist. And I think actually during most of his career saw himself as a populist, although he certainly was a populist of a very right-wing sort. But in any case, you've had these populists and some people on the left who believe that you can build unity by finding those items that we share in common and not speaking specifically or clearly about the differential. And I think that has been true of Senator Sanders. And I think that, and so let's be clear, this is not suggesting that Senator Sanders is some sort of racist. It is not ignoring the fact that he was involved in the civil rights movement. But it goes back in a lot of ways to this idea of his conception of the narrative. Is race in the United States context simply an add-on, or in the alternative, is it actually central to this system? I would argue that race is actually the mortar that holds U.S. capitalism together.
And I would find agreement with you there. And as you were speaking, I couldn't help but start thinking about trickle-down theories and how we have had this theory of trickle-down economics, but also at play very much in the society are the ideas, very much in the left part of the society, is this idea of trickle-down justice. And that you That's really right. have to be more, much more intentional about justice if we want to find unity.
No, that's very, very important. And it's interesting you raise it because I'm looking literally right before this interview, I was looking at an educational curriculum around racial justice. And what was interesting for me was the absence of a discussion of history. And I think that that race in the United States does not make sense in the absence of understanding the history of the construction of race, in the post 1492 period. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's not simply propaganda. There are systems that have been put into place that operate fairly autonomously of the wishes and control of specific individuals because of the way that they were put into place. And therefore, you don't get rid of them by any kind of trickle-down anything, or you don't get rid of them by introducing programs that theoretically assist everybody but don't target the differential.
Well said, well said. Something for us all to keep in mind going forward. Now, Black Lives Matter has captured the attention of the public to mixed reviews. Despite the support for Black Lives Matter in organizations like Move to Amend and others, BLM has taken heat from whites, including those on the left, for bird-dogging Sanders, and more recently for not endorsing any candidate. What role is Black Lives Matter playing in building the democracy movement, and why is it important for white folks to get behind them?
So I'm glad that they have not endorsed any candidate. Black Lives Matter, we have to be clear, is an organization. There's also a movement for Black Lives, and these two things really need to be distinguished, just for the purposes of clarity. Because there are people that go around saying that they are part of Black Lives Matter, and what they are is part of a broader movement. They're not necessarily part of the organization that goes by that name, which is, if we have time, we can discuss that whole issue later. The what the movement for Black Lives, including Black Lives Matter, have done is that they've helped to shift and shape the discourse on race. They have done around race what Occupy did around economic inequality. And they've played an invaluable role. There is no particular reason for Black Lives Matter or for the movement for Black Lives to endorse a particular candidate. Now, the issue about the criticisms of going after Sanders, et cetera, those are tactical questions. And I think that what's happened, and that one can disagree. Honest people can disagree on different tactics. There was I think that the action that was taken at Netroots was absolutely appropriate and very well done. I'm less sanguine about what happened in Seattle. And I think that the issue of criticizing or unsettling these candidates can be very, very helpful in terms of getting the candidates to focus on some of these issues of racial justice. So I think that that's critically important. But let's go to the deeper part of your question. What unsettles many whites is the issue of the racial differential. It is that people do not really want to discuss. So what happens is there is frequently a focus on a particular incident. Did the police in the case of Eric Garner have the right to do blank? Right, as opposed to looking at patterns. For example, one of the things that I think should be asked to a white audience is this: how do you explain that black men in their early 20s are 21 times more likely than white men in the same age bracket to be shot and killed by the police, right? How do you explain that?
Yeah.
21 times. Now, I think that's the kind of discussion that Black Lives Matter has provoked. And some people who are really serious about understanding the racial differential have taken this up. It's a discussion that needs to happen with whites to ask, to really grapple with, well, what does that mean? Another example is there was a study done a few years ago, it was a very interesting one, where there were two cars, identical cars, and this was in California. They were given the same route. There were eight men, four white, four black. The one car with four white men was given a route through L.A. The other car, same exact car, with four black men, given the same route through Los Angeles. The car with the white men sailed through Los Angeles and got to their destination. The car with the four black men was stopped by the police, I think, 3 to 5 times. I don't remember the exact number. So the question then is, well, why? How do we explain that? What exactly is going on here? See, that's the uncomfortable discussion that the movement for Black Lives has advanced. And it becomes really important that our new generation of John Browns and Ann Bradens basically push that discussion among whites and ask those hard questions. And some of those questions, to be honest, will not be answered honestly if it's a mixed audience. That I think that there's some discussions that whites are going to just simply have to have by themselves, where they're going to be forced to be very direct and honest about their feelings. And so I think that that's what has been very powerful, as well as uncomfortable for many people, in the rise of the movement for Black Lives.
Before we go into the next question or the segment, this is an important issue that you just talked on, that you just spoke on when you said that people have to get within the white audiences and specify those things. Now, the example that you gave with the car driving through LA is one issue. The problem with that particular case is that white people inherently look at black men as ominous. Okay. Mm-hmm. In other words, inherently, many see them as more dangerous than white. So one of the things that I always talk about when trying to instruct white people, if you will, about these types of issues is go first, because they will see the cop's reaction as, and this has been told by all white audiences that I've actually exposed to the leaders of before, what they would actually say is that, well, that happens because inherently black men are more dangerous. So that issue, until they're taught that's a fallacy, I think you also have to go with issues like, example, same group, one group, white guys use marijuana, same age. Black guys use marijuana, same age. The difference in the penalties are huge. That's right. Can understand in an unbiased fashion. When it comes to the cops going through LA, in as much as they're wrong, they can self-justify that by saying, well, inherently, black men act more dangerously. Do you see what I'm saying?
I think it's a very good point you're raising, and let me just go you one. I think that the issue of the alleged inherent violence of black men is a matter that needs to be interrogated with whites very directly. It's like, where does this fear issue come from? You know, what's the, and this is why I said earlier on that history is so important. You can't have that discussion without talking about slavery. You just simply can't, right? In the absence of a discussion of history, it ends up being simply an abstraction at best, right? And you know, people argue about, well, you know, there's these crime figures and those crime figures. But is that to say that then let's look at the lynchings. What were the lynchings about? Was that about crime? How do you explain people gathering together as if it was a Sunday picnic to watch black men hung and burned, right? How does one explain? Does that have something to do with crime, right? See, so when you push these issues, again, this is not the American way of thinking, because we don't like history in this country.
Right.
We oppose history in this country. We uphold myth. We oppose history. And see, I think what we have to understand is that those of us, people of conscience, progressive people, we have to reintroduce history. And so this issue about fear, which you're raising, my God, you're absolutely right. So let's look at the historical roots of this. And that's part of the discussion that has to happen with whites.
Absolutely. What I always say, willful ignorance is an important part of maintaining the status quo. Willful ignorance is important. We'll continue this conversation after a quick public service announcement.
Does your elected representative support amending the Constitution to end corporate constitutional rights and get money out of politics? You can help us find out by joining Move to Amend's Pledge to Amend campaign. Help persuade local, state, and federal legislators to pledge support for our We the People amendment. Recruit co-sponsors for this amendment in the U.S. House and Senate. For more information, visit movetoamend.org/pledge-amend. That's movetoamend.org/pledge-amend.
You can support Move to Amend reports and other Move to Amend programs by joining our $28 for the 28th Amendment monthly sustainer campaign. Pledge $28 a month and help make the We the People Amendment our 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Visit movetoamend.org/donate to sign up.
You're listening to Move to Amend reports, where we connect the dots between the current issues of our time and the nature of corporate rule. We're talking with international activist Bill Fletcher Jr. about the difference between campaigns and movements.
Now, there are certainly a number of white folks climbing on the bandwagon of another anti-establishment candidate in this race, much to their embarrassment, Republican front runner. That's who he is. On one side, you have a bunch of folks interested in social and economic equality, and on the other side, you've got folks who are interested in social and economic security only for themselves, and some of them are prone to violence. We are also witnessing the two major parties nominate the least likable and least trustworthy candidates in the often. What impact is this election having in communities of color, and what opportunities can you identify for coalition and alliance building?
So I'm going to ask your indulgence for a second in mm-hmm. answering this, because there's actually an interesting linkage with the last point that was being made about willful ignorance.
Exactly.
And it has to do with the Trump supporters, the Trump and the Cruz supporters. One of the things that we've got to understand that's going on within white America is not simply that there's been a declining living standard for most working people since the mid-1970s. That in and of itself is an important factor, but why it's particularly important is that it wasn't supposed to happen to white people. See, the myth,
yes.
Right? The myth was that if you work hard, you'll do well, right? You work hard, the lives of your children will be better than your own. And to the extent that you fight and retain your whiteness, you should always be in a better position than someone of color. That's the deal that no one wants to talk about in this country. That's the deal. And so where does willful ignorance come in? Willful ignorance comes in that huge parts of the population, including but not exclusively whites, have chosen over the years to be silent in the face of atrocities.
Yes.
And the atrocities, both domestic as well as global. I just give you a few examples. In 1965, the CIA and British intelligence helped orchestrate a coup d'etat in Indonesia that resulted in the deaths of somewhere between 500,000 and 3 million people. 500,000 to 3 million.
Yeah.
Now, and that was the coup that brought General Suharto to power. Now, you raise that in the United States, and most people have no idea about this coup. They say, well, I didn't know. Okay. Let's go to Latin America. Guatemala.
Oh, please.
Guatemala, we had, in effect, a race war where somewhere between 275,000 and 500,000 Guatemalans were killed, mainly Mayans, by regimes backed by and funded by the United States. So you bring this up in the United, you know, regular people. I didn't know. Right? Okay, you didn't know. All right, so let's go back over to Indonesia. So the Indonesian government invaded East Timor twice, 1975, with the support right after Gerald Ford, then president, and Henry Kissinger had left Indonesia, and then in the 1990s, carried out massacres. Bring that up? I didn't know. So at a certain point, people around the world say, are you guys stupid? I mean, is that really the problem in the United States, that you all are just idiots? I mean, how is it at a certain point that you cannot know these things? That's what people want to know, right? That's one of the reasons that people from the United States are frequently looked at in such strange ways. We're treated very politely in most parts of the world, but people often look at us like very strangely. Like, where are you actually from? Are you all really that dumb? I mean, really,
yes.
Is that what's going on in the United States? Is it something in the water
that it's
makes you especially stupid, right?
Yes.
Or, in the alternative, is it that you decided to put wax in your ears like Ulysses sailors when they were bringing their boats by the sirens?
Yes.
Right? And so this willful ignorance is a really important point. Because therein you understand the anger of the Trump supporters and the Cruz supporters. You see, they had a deal. They had a deal. Their deal was they fight to be white, they keep their mouths shut, they allow atrocities to happen, and their lives were supposed to improve. But no, what's happening? Their lives are collapsing. Somebody betrayed them. Somebody betrayed them. And they're looking around and they're trying to figure out, who is it? Who betrayed me?
The extractive nature of capitalism.
Well, Trump provide answers. They provide answers. And it depends on which day of the week it is.
Yes.
In terms of what the answer is. And that's what's so dangerous about this moment. And that's, again, why it's so important to talk history. Because we've got to understand what's motivating these folks. Because I don't actually think most of them are stupid. There are stupid people. I mean, you clearly hear it in some of these interviews. It's like, my God, what planet are they on? But most of these folks are not stupid.
They're
really angry and they feel so betrayed.
Bill, they're not stupid. They are, and I speak about this a lot of times on my show, they are actually ill-informed. And we have a media that's a part of the corrupting factor that creates it, and all that you've said, it's amazing. It is what we're doing here at Move to Amend, right? Having guests like yourself on, somebody with the knowledge that to express this to our audience, and not because we have a progressive audience, but 90% of what you just said, our audience is likely unaware of. I'm originally from Central America, Panama. They're unaware that when Bush invaded Panama, 10,000 Panamanians died while they said 1,000, in as much as
right.
We try to get the information out. So you're absolutely correct on what you're saying.
No, I mean, the atrocity in 1989 is one of these atrocities. It's amazing that they got away with it. And it just simply continued to deny, no, it wasn't that bad. Well, no, it's actually worse.
Right.
And I think that we really have to have this discussion with regular people, because they're not stupid. But you see, the other thing I'd say is that it's not just the ill-informed. I'm gonna push you on this one.
Okay.
There is a collective delusion mm-hmm. that the right wing has created. And it's a nicer, a more formal term would be sophistry, right? But it's a collective delusion that the right wing has created. And you see, the thing is, within this, let's think about it metaphorically as a bubble. The delusion is a bubble. Within this bubble, all kinds of things make sense. The problem is, outside of the bubble, it makes no sense. So climate denial, within the bubble, Fox News and others reinforce all of this nonsense that there's no climate change, right? That it's really something else. Or
right.
the birther movement. Think about the birther movement, right? And the way that various elements of the birther movement reinforced one another again mm-hmm. and again, right? And so you have this bubble, this collective delusion that people are operating in, and it's self-reinforcing. It is very hard to challenge unless you somehow break the bubble or get outside of the bubble. And so the right wing has been very successful at that. And with new technology, I would argue, it becomes even easier to create
right.
collective delusion and this bubble, because people don't have to share information. You can exist within this bubble. I found out that a cousin of mine, you know, is like stuck on Fox News, and I'm trying to figure out, this is an African American woman. It's like, how did she lose her mind? You know, she's like living inside of this bubble, and yeah. everything in that bubble reinforces these incredibly reactionary views. So that's why I'd say it's more than just ill-informed. There are many, I mean, people are ill-informed. That's true. We don't
right.
know history. And geography, all of that
Bill,
is true. But
I think you're absolutely right. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, it gives people a comfort zone. When you speak about your cousin or whomever the family mm-hmm. member is, it gives
yeah.
a certain comfort level generally because of the environment that you're in. I have a particular part of my family as well that lives within that bubble. Black person as well. And
uh-huh.
so I mean, that is common. But to get back into the question, I'm going to try to tailor it now to the
narrative.
No, I'm sorry.
I apologize.
No, not at all. I think what you've introduced here is important. And not only that, adds to the question that I asked. Because when I say what is the impact of the election on the communities, that goes directly into the statement that you just made. Because what is an impact of an election from an ill-informed or people who live in a bubble, and how do we integrate that, or how do we integrate a movement into a community or into communities that can actually mitigate that?
So I'm going to answer that on a few different levels. Let me start with the bad news, and that is, or I should say, with the bad guys. The bad guys are really energized in this election because they see this as the opportunity to reassert the white republic. That's what Cruz and Trump are talking about. And when Trump talks about we have to retake America, whatever, make America great again, they're basically talking about reasserting the dominance of the white republic framework. That basically this is a white people's country and everyone else is a guest, welcomed or unwelcomed. And so from their standpoint, that's what's at stake. That's why they're so energized. That's why, despite the irony of elements of the Republican Party not having fundamental differences with many things that President Obama suggested, they nevertheless hated him from the very beginning. They despised him. They would not give him the benefit of the doubt because his mere existence challenged the basic concept of the white republic. So this election for them is about that. Now, on the side of the good guys, it's very complicated because we have we have the Sanders candidacy. We have many people that I respect who are supporting Clinton. You notice the distinction I'm using in my words. But you have people that are looking for progressive change. And deeper problem for me is, and why I worry about some of these things, is that what happens every 4 years is that progressive-minded people, liberals and progressives, get drawn into presidential elections. But the rest of the time, many of us take a pass from the electoral realm, whereas our opponents never take a pass. And they are working steadily at the state and local level to shift the balance of power in some very fundamental ways, including trying to build up a head of steam so that there can be a constitutional convention in order to amend the U.S. Constitution, which people don't seem to want to discuss. I don't know whether it's like a high level of denial or what. So when I think about these elections and communities and issues of movements, I guess I start with that you can't build a movement simply at election time. And that a movement really is going to be operating on multiple levels, hopefully at least, an overall social movement, that there will be an electoral component, but there will also be mass action, street protests, legal actions, a variety of different things. That at the electoral level, we need a very comprehensive national strategy. This goes beyond one election. So when Senator Sanders talks about a political revolution, I would say that unless this is simply rhetoric, mere metaphor, then you really have to be talking about strategy, not people feeling good about change, but real strategy that looks at state by state what needs to be done. And many of us don't have the patience to do that. You know, I was in Texas about a year ago giving a talk, and I've told this story a few times because it really it did something. The incident did something to me. So I'm giving a talk, and so then we're in question and answer, and you know, one after another, people are telling me about the terrible situation in Texas. It's like, oh, you know, there's this happening and there's that happening. So I listened. And then I said to the audience, how do we take over Texas? And people looked at me like, did this guy just like pop a pill or something? It's like,
yeah, because most people say, who wants to take over Texas? But go ahead.
Hey, yeah, well, there you go. But it's like, what is he
doing? Hey, guys, I'm in Texas.
Hey, no. And it's like, I said, well, like, I could tell they were saying, what is he thinking about, right? I said, wait a minute. Look at the demographic changes that are going on in Texas. I mean, this is a state everybody knows is going to be in play at the presidential level certainly by the next election cycle. And so what are we progressives doing? What kind of strategy do we have that's focused on how do we win power for working people in Texas? And I don't mean just like a, you know, one person's campaign in Austin or a ballot initiative in Houston. I mean like really winning power. And I don't mean just, you know, like in the last gubernatorial election in Texas, when many people were assuming that the liberal candidate was going to do much better than she did. It's more about thinking long term and plotting out the strategy. Who are the forces that need to be mobilized in order to win power for working people in Texas? Again, a lot of us just don't seem to have the patience for that discussion. So when I'm thinking about the elections and our communities and movements, that's the direction that I think that we have to be going in if we are particularly serious about this, because we can't remain at the level of defensive movements. You know, I'm tired of going to demonstrations that, you know, that where the slogans are stop such and such or repeal such and such or defend such and such. I want to go to demonstrations where we're saying we want, we deserve.
You're bringing up an interesting point, and it's one that we at Move to Amend very much agree with, in that for the past 2 years, our national leadership team has been writing out a strategic plan, a 10-year strategic plan to pass the We the People Amendment. That, I mean, it's details. We need to pass, you know, we need this many co-sponsors. We need this many states. We need, you know, all the different things. We need to build coalitions across all the communities that are oppressed in the country. And you know, so we have a very organized and detailed plan on how we plan to get there. And we hope to share it with as far and wide as with as many can, so we can get other people thinking strategically as well. So your point is not lost on us at all.
Lauren, did you finish with that one? Because
yes.
I really want
yes.
to plug, pick up one other issue that Bill mentioned about tired of actually going to these demonstrations. In fact, there are a lot of demonstrations I don't go to anymore because that's all they are. Somebody raises a bunch of noise and people, the police gets there and they just keep things under control. And when it's over and nothing changes. Mm-hmm. One of the issues we have, Bill, is that many of our progressives are in effect sellouts. I mean, let's just look at the person on the top of our ticket right now, actually being a person who, elected or not, will be indebted to the 1%, as we normally say, but meaning to the Wall Street class. Now, how do we get, and this is a part of Move to Amend as well, how do we get folks to do the hard work and not, given that it's going to be very hard work and not necessarily glamorous work, but hard work in which they won't be paid much, in which there won't be a lot of money there. However, if they just pander a bit, they could probably get a good paying lobbying job.
Well, okay, so let me start with something that I heard Sarah Silverman say when she was talking about before Sanders entered the race, she was supporting Hillary. And she basically said that because of the way the system operates, she saw what Hillary did and didn't do as not particularly different from the other folks.
Mm-hmm.
That Sanders, however, was a difference, which is why she was supporting Sanders. Now, I want to start there because what I think we have to understand is that we have a very undemocratic and very corrupt electoral system that pushes even the most honest people in a direction that is sometimes like going up against a bulldozer and you have a bicycle. When I was in Boston in the 1980s, towards the end of the 1980s, I was encouraged by some people to run for state legislature and state representative. And it was something that was very intriguing. And it was against an incumbent who was quite powerful. This would have been a Democratic primary, Democratic Party primary. And I found out that this guy had a war chest, and this is in the late 80s, of like, I don't know, $100,000, $200,000, something like that. This was a state legislator, state representative, not a congressperson.
Yes, that's
and,
a lot of money in the 1980s.
Right? Yes, and so for me to run, I'd have to raise significant money. And I chose not to for a variety of reasons, I'm not saying that to sound moralistic or something. I just chose not to. But my point is that I've met enough political leaders, people who I think in many cases have the best of intentions and are very positive, who are stuck and they're caught in this bind around money. And the system forces them in a certain kind of direction. Now, what do we do about that? Well, obviously, at some point, we have to overturn Citizens United. We have to somehow take money out of elections. That's going to be a long road. In the meantime, in order to get the kinds of people that we want to run, for office to run, we need organization. And it's more than like ad hoc organization. We need real organization. I have been an advocate for years of what I call a neo-rainbow type organization. That is, mm-hmm. borrowing the best elements of what Jackson did and built from 84 up until March of 1989. To build an organization which has its own program, which is independent, that can run candidates within the Democratic primaries, but also can run independently if it so chooses. That we need organization because, you know, thinking back on when people approached me to run for state reps, you know, basically they were saying, well, Bill, you should think about it. Not, Bill, we're going to help to build the campaign. Bill, we're going to
raise the money. Right.
Like, Bill, you know, here's an
go
idea.
Go run.
Right? And it's like, that's not very helpful. You know, and not knowing who's with me, who's going to be participating in building a base, who already has a base. You know, and so what ends up happening is, in effect, we defer political candidacies to people who can afford to run.
So true.
And that has to be challenged.
Yes, absolutely true.
Coming up next, we have a conversation about the role of labor unions and race in building a democracy movement with guest Bill Fletcher Jr. We'll get the ball rolling right after this public service announcement.
Help raise awareness about the movement to amend the Constitution by hosting your own House Party for Democracy. Invite family, friends, and neighbors for a screening of our mini-documentary, Legalize Democracy. To find the film and learn how to get started with your House Party, visit movetoamend.org/houseparties. That's one word, movetoamend.org/houseparties.
Move to Amend's We the People Amendment is the only proposed amendment in Congress that addresses both Supreme Court-created doctrines of corporate personhood and money as speech, the very foundation of corporate rule. Passing the We the People Amendment is the necessary first step in transforming our democracy to one that truly represents the 99%. Go to movetoamend.org/amendment, read it, and take action today.
Now, our discussion of the presidential contest has pretty much been contained within the two major parties. Jill Stein is running as the Green candidate on an anti-establishment platform, and Gary Johnson is the Libertarian candidate. That said, for systemic reasons, it will boil down to an elephant or an ass. Far too many people think voting is the only act of democracy. We view it as the least of democratic acts. From your perspective, what does a real participatory democracy look like?
Oh, wow. Let me answer it like this. So let me start with actually why I think voting is so important. And then I want to go broader than that. But I do want to start with this issue of why voting is so important. I voted, I believe, in every election since I turned 18. And part of the reason is because rich people do it all the time. So I figure if rich people do it, then they must know something. And if they think it's important and they already are the dominant force, then that tells me something about the importance of elections. And when I think about the struggles that have taken place in this country for voting rights, whether it was African Americans in the South, Chicanos in the Southwest, wherever, it just seems to me that it's incomprehensible that one would sit home. It's just incomprehensible. But the problem is, as you said, that democracy ends up being restricted to what one does on the first Tuesday of November. And pretty much the first Tuesday in November every 4 years, since people seem to forget the midterm elections, many progressive people. and so I think that you're right, that that view itself must be criticized. When I think about democracy, I think about democracy with a small d, that is the democratization of society, which means, in effect, that there is popular control at all different levels, in all spheres, whether we're talking about health, whether we're talking about jobs, whether we're talking about education. I'll give you an example. The non-union workplace in the United States is an authoritarian environment. Now, we don't normally think about that like that. But Barbara Ehrenreich, back in around 2000, wrote a major piece basically raising this question about the absence of basic rights for working people in the workplace. There is no freedom of speech in the workplace. There is no freedom of the press. There really isn't any freedom of association. You are under the thumb of a dictator. And workers know this. They really do, but they don't verbalize it, right? It's rare that you'll get someone to actually say on their own, it's like a totalitarian system. You know, they'll complain about the boss. They personalize it as, I've got a jammed up boss or whatever. But they generally don't think about living in an authoritarian environment where there are no rights. And so part of what I think that the battle is to democratize. For example, why are we not engaging in struggles all around this country to introduce into state constitutions rights for workers in the workplace, irrespective of whether they have a union? Why aren't there protections? Why isn't there a just cause provision in every state constitution for workers in terms of termination? That if you get terminated, that it has to be for just cause, yeah, outside of an economic, like a economic downturn. We think about democracy so narrowly. Why aren't we fighting to democratize the workplace?
You know, we're actually going to be asking you about labor unions in the next question, but I mean, it's so it wasn't going to cover that real in-depth piece that you just brought up here, and how profound is it? If Texas is a right to work state, mm-hmm, right?
That's
one
right.
Would think that exactly what you said there, that if it really were right to work and really cared about the workers and really had a problems with unions because of, let's assume unions are corrupt, one would give it to the legislature, that give them the opportunity to pass laws that are there, in fact, to protect workers. But generally, we don't get that. In the legislature, we get laws to protect businesses, to protect corporations. So, I mean, what you just said there, I mean, I had never quite articulated it that way. And I think it's a new frame that we have to give it, that, okay, so you have issues with unions. How comes if you care that much about workers, weren't these things instituted into law? Very good
right.
point. Very good point.
And it also adds to the phrase corporate rule, which has many, many different tentacles. But this
That's
is
right,
definitely
exactly.
a really direct impact of corporate rule, where they are physically and mentally ruling your being.
Absolutely.
Why in Texas wouldn't we run a campaign for rights at work? Not right to work, rights at work.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Why not move a constitutional amendment in the state constitution that gives workers basic constitutional rights?
Absolutely.
Freedom of association, freedom of speech, right?
Absolutely. Move to Amend reports, listeners, this is the reason why we bring you several, the thought process from several others within the movement in general. But anyhow, let's move on, Bill, and it goes as follows. This is a big question. Labor unions have played an important role in the past U.S. social movements and continue to play a somewhat dysfunctional role in U.S. elections. You know, unions have been effectively demonized, like we were speaking about earlier, and in some instances for good reason. But for the most part, they act as a counterweight to upwards wealth redistribution. And for that reason, we view labor unions as part of the democracy movement as well. I've been known to say that every single person who works for another, meaning another corporation or whatever, should form part of a union. But anyhow, please speak to the significance of U.S. labor history and the state of unions today, and please include some comments on the integration of labor unions.
Okay, so we're going to be going on the phone for at least another 3 hours.
Yeah, you got 3 minutes.
Yeah. So let me do a couple of things. One is that I want to make a plug for my book, They're Bankrupting Us, and 20 Other Myths
Please
About
do.
Unions.
Please
right?
do.
And I think that the book was written, it was commissioned by Beacon Press, and it was written in order to address actually a number of the questions that you just raised.
Mm-hmm.
And it's written and aimed at people who don't know a lot about unions, may not know anything about unions, or may watch too much Fox News. So I really want to make a plug to your listeners to take a look at the book. And I believe, because of the kind of feedback I've gotten, that you'll find it useful. The second thing is, as I say in that book, that the labor-management relations in the United States are the most violent and have been the most violent of any of the advanced capitalist countries. And the violence is not because, contrary to some of the things you see on TV, it's not because of workers and striking. It's because of the viciousness of the repression that workers have received when they try to exercise their right to freedom of association. And so in the United States, it was not uncommon in the 19th century and the early 20th century, early to mid 20th century, to have strikes met with the violence from the state. The state militia or the National Guards would turn out. Machine guns were used. The Ludlow Massacre in Colorado is a case in point. Field artillery was used on occasion, as well as various kinds of death squads that were used against people. In the 1934 Great Textile Strike, which was a national strike that involved hundreds of thousands of people around the country, the states, several southern states, forcibly interned families of strikers in detention camps.
Amazing.
In South Carolina, Tennessee, a number of places. And it's very hard to dig that history up, although there's a great film that came out in 1994 called The Uprising of 34 that talks about the textile strike and about some of what I'm just laying out. So I think the second thing we have to understand is that in the United States, that the corporate
structure,
the tyrants, for lack of a better term,
right.
They are worried about the organization of workers. Their fear and antipathy towards unions is less about money, because they will spend money. They'll spend money to prevent the unionization of workers. So what is it that they fear? They fear the loss of control.
Exactly.
They want
exactly.
total
and absolute control. Again, remember what I said. It's an authoritarian environment. In any authoritarian system, those at the top do not want to be challenged, and they will take whatever steps are necessary in order to thwart that.
Well,
so,
Bill.
Yes.
Remember the Powell Manifesto.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Which I think is another thing that people must read and understand, because when you look at the Powell memo, what you then understand is it's like essentially the playbook for the right from the late 1960s to the present. And then you look at the work of people like Richard Viguerie and others that were organizing a segment of the right and were doing what we on the left should be doing right now. That
exactly.
Really working through the strategy and tactics of multi-level movement building, right? So unions are the most effective means for redistributing wealth and for winning, gaining a modicum of power for workers. And unions have all kinds of problems because, knock, knock, welcome to the United States. Right? I mean, these unions, it's not like they operate in some other country and just happen to be passing through. They have all the problems that are related to the toxicity of the U.S. system. However, when you don't have them, then you have the further encroachment of authoritarianism. And so but they are very complicated, which is something that I try to get at in both of those books that I
Well then Bill, how does a union reinvent itself so that it can actually regain the respect that it had from the worker? It never had the respect. Well, it had the forced respect of the plutocracy, but it never really had the respect. How does it regain the respect of the worker? Because right now, if you take a look at a place like Texas, the folks here, again, and I use the same word again, are so ill-informed that they think somehow unions are a detriment to them. The majority of Texans believe unions are a detriment to them, and they rather be under, in your parlance, the heels of the boss.
Yeah. Sometimes people prefer the security of a boot on their neck than the possibility of freedom.
Change. Yeah.
Yeah. Because the boot on the neck is secure. I mean, you understand where you find yourself. There's no ambiguity.
Right.
Unfortunately, that's true time and again. Well, you see, here's the thing about the union movement and why it needs to reinvent itself or transform. The union movement has to transform for a number of different reasons, including the changes in the economy, the changes in technology, the changes in the workforce itself. And in order to do that, unions need to become educational machines, by which I mean they need to become much more a source of learning, of gaining new insights and new information about what's going on, of helping people address the myriad of issues that they face, whether they might be workplace or non-workplace, which means that the union has to be exceedingly good at listening. Active listening as an organization, not shining people on, not smiling and then moving on, but really actively listening to the concerns of workers, which obviously means, maybe for some people it's not obvious, that they have to be democratically controlled. And so one aspect of that that I feel very strongly about is term limits. That the unions need term limits for their leaders. And I don't mean stupid term limits. I remember that when I was younger, there was a union that their elections for president were like every 2 years. And then there was some sort of idiotic term limit. I mean that you know, when you're talking about, like, someone is in office 10 years, 12 years, that's enough. That's enough.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
time. It's time to step out. Now, maybe you come back after you've been out a term. But what we have to understand is that when people hold office indefinitely, what ends up happening is that a bubble emerges around them that makes them impervious to criticism and makes them very, very arrogant, actually.
Right, right.
And they don't feel like they need to listen. But the other thing that happens is that people actually do run out of ideas.
Right.
And they're in the same environment time and again. They get used to answering questions in a certain way, and they're not prepared, particularly for changes in the strategic situation. And therefore, you need to have new blood. And I think that there's many organizations, many union organizations, that simply have had people that have stayed on too long. Now, the final thing is about this is that the union needs to refound its mission. And
mm-hmm.
one of the things that my co-author Fernando Gapacin and I argued in Solidarity Divided is that we need a unionism that we call social justice unionism. It's a unionism that goes beyond the limits of fighting simply for wages, hours, and working conditions at particular workplaces, but really starts to challenge for power for working people, both in
right.
the workplace as well as outside, which means, in effect, you have to be building alliances with other social movements, taking on the environment, taking on healthcare, whatever the case may be. So it's really shifting the paradigm of unionism. And this is very, very hard. I'm a Star Trek fan, as most people that know me know. And I'm into science fiction generally, but very much love Star Trek. And there was in Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, there was this scene because the Federation, represented by the crew of the Enterprise, is entertaining the leadership of the Klingon Empire, and the Klingon Empire and the Federation have always been at odds, but now they're talking peace. So the chancellor for the Klingon Empire says to Captain Kirk something like this: the change we're talking about is going to be most difficult for our generation. And I've always thought about that. The change is going to be most difficult because it's those of us that have been raised within a certain framework that are now being called upon to think differently. It's like being given a new kind of computer software that you're just not ready for. You've been very comfortable with another kind of software, and now someone is saying, no, you can't use that anymore. You really have to use this one, which means that you have to relearn things that you had taken for granted.
Right.
And that's part of the problem in the union movement, that that in order for the union movement to avoid extinction and in order for the union movement to reemerge as a vibrant force, there is a new way of looking at things that is going to be very, very uncomfortable for so many people.
So true, my friend, so true.
You know, we've been covering the establishment and development of the Washington State Farm Workers Union, Familias Unidas por la Justicia, with great interest. It is a farm worker built and led organization fighting for the most basic labor rights. While recognizing the imprisonment and torture reserved only for slaves, the more we learn about the history and heritage of migrant farm workers, the more we're able to draw correlations to American slavery and certainly indentured servitude. Black people and brown people share a long history of oppression in agricultural fields and in labor unions, but have not historically organized together. What role should organized labor be playing here, if any, and do you see a pathway for successful integration of farm workers and other brown labor communities into the overall labor movement?
Well, to begin with the last part, the answer is yes, but it necessitates the kind of social justice unionist framework that I was laying out before, the recognition that a labor movement is not simply the trade unions, but it represents multiple forms of worker organization that come together to fight for workers' rights. And so that kind of orientation is essential in order to embrace the farm workers movement that you're describing. I think that the other part of what I would argue here is that farm workers are not protected legally at the national level. That was part of the deal when the National Labor Relations Act was passed in the 1930s, that the Southern interests in political interests and economic interests did not want to see farm workers and domestics organized because the Southern and Southwestern, they saw and recognized that unionization and the ability to unionize could also have a dramatic impact on the issues of political power for these especially oppressed groupings. So farm workers have had a hard way to go, and where they have legal protections at all, it's dependent on state laws. And therefore, they absolutely need broad alliances. These are fights that they engage in that they simply cannot engage by themselves. They need allies from outside of the labor movement. They need them, obviously, in the union movement, but they also need people much broader. The United Farm Workers of America for many years was very successful in doing this. But they, over time, for a variety of reasons that go beyond the scope of our show, declined, and they lost their strength. So I think in looking at the state of Washington and the farm workers movement there, or in other places like in Florida and the Carolinas, what's critical is building broad alliances and understanding that this is a fight fundamentally for justice.
Excellent. Now, Bill, Detroit, Michigan, Flint, Michigan, both big labor towns in their heyday, both chocolate cities. In discussing labor unions, no conversation is complete without a discussion of free trade deals, which exacerbate racism and class lines. How have these deals undermined labor unions and Black communities, and what is labor doing about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, especially as it relates to the current election?
Well, this is probably going to have to be my last question.
Sure.
And unfortunately, because I think we could go on for quite a while. Okay, so first, we need to understand that free trade agreements have consistently undermined the strength of workers because it drives pressures towards the bottom. I mean, it's interesting when you're looking historically. The United States fought a civil war that was over essentially two issues. One was slavery, and the other was free trade. The Confederate States of America, in alliance with the British, wanted free trade. And what free trade would have meant would have been that that the South could have sold cotton and tobacco to Europe and gotten products from Europe much cheaper than anything that was going to be produced in the North, which would have killed Northern industry. So lesson number one is that there is no economic power on this planet that ever developed within a free trade regime. None. Every economic power that emerged at some point had tariffs to protect the development and growth of their domestic industries. So when you hear these people talking about the wonderful things about free trade, you just simply ask about this. Well, how does that explain that? Now, the second thing is that what this means in the current world is that global capitalism has reorganized in ways that involve the development of new free trade regimes and the elimination of various kinds of so-called tariff barriers. Now, this has particularly hurt countries in the global south. Even though, I mean, certainly places like Detroit, Flint, and others have suffered with the loss of industry, and I'll come back to that, that what the free trade regimes have meant is that the countries in the global south that need to develop their own industries have been denied that because they have to compete with industries that are much more developed. And those industries may or may not be located in countries of the global north, but they're largely controlled by elites in the global north. Now, what's happened in the United States is that, first of all, U.S. companies became very content and did not keep up with technological changes. So that when you had the reemergence of Japan and Germany, particularly as competitors, U.S. companies were not ready for that. And that was like one slam against the economy here, the workforce. But what free trade has meant is that it is more cost effective for multinational corporations to get much of their work done where there's a cheaper workforce. And thus the growing working class on this planet is found in places like China, Vietnam, Thailand, the Philippines, Taiwan, certain parts of Latin America, etc., and other parts of it in places like Bangladesh and India. And so the industries that we had been relying on for employment have in many cases either shut down or shrunk or retooled. And this is a critically important point. The United States continues to be a manufacturing power. The notion that the United States no longer manufactures is an illusion. It's wrong. It manufactures more products than it did 30, 40 years ago, but with fewer people. So you have steel mills, for example, that have closed in cities like Youngstown, Ohio, and they move into the woods. So they close auto plants or whatever that have closed in Wisconsin in urban areas and have moved into rural areas. And there's a long history of this in the United States, of industries moving into rural areas where there are fewer or no unions or fewer people of color. So what's happening with this, the free trade, it's not just free trade. It's the reorganization of global capitalism that is, in fact, crushing people. And you have this paradoxical situation where this is going on while immense amount of wealth are being transferred to the top, where you have, 40 people, 50 people, I think now, that have more wealth than half the planet?
Half the world's population.
Right? Yes. Exactly. And it's absolutely disgraceful, so that we actually should be talking about the need for a global redistribution of wealth. Which obviously is contrary to any notion of free trade.
I know you need to go, but I want to add an important corollary and hear a little opinion on that. I am of the thought that one of the reasons we are attempting to make governments like the American government and other governments weak in lieu of a TPP is just that, to remove borders in such a manner that it's the plutocracy, and I'm not talking about the U.S. plutocracy, but the world plutocracy, that's actually then in control of the world's economy.
Yeah, that's right. The transnational
capitalist class. That's what we're actually talking about. The transnational capitalist class, which has come to be a dominant force. So
well, we very much appreciate your being here today, Bill, and for being so generous with your time. But just I know you've put somebody off, but just please take 30 seconds to tell folks how they can buy your book and any other final thought you might like to leave.
Sure. So my book is available. The Solidarity Divided is published by the University of California Press, and They're Bankrupting Us is published by Beacon Press. So they're both available through the websites of those publishers. You can also buy them through Amazon. And most bookstores, if they don't have it, will certainly order it for you.
Look, thank you very much for your time, Bill. It was a great conversation.
Thank you. It was my pleasure and honor. Take care.
Take care, too. Bill. Thank you.
Are you part of a faith or ethical community whose values and principles are being violated by corporate actions? We, the people of the Move to Amend Interfaith Caucus, share in common a variety of values and principles. In this unity, we find the short-sighted and single-minded drive for profits by certain corporations has led to the degradation of the environment and our society. Corporate power has come to dominate our existence, with the values and principles we all hold dear being routinely violated by powerful corporations using their so-called personhood to influence elections, legislation, regulations, and judicial outcomes in their favor and at our expense. It is the purpose of the Interfaith Caucus to engage faith and ethical communities and educate about how the work of ending corporate rule can be approached from a spiritual, ethical, or religious perspective. Working together at national, state, local, and faith community levels, we can pass the We the People Amendment. Join us on our monthly calls the third Wednesday of each month at 12 noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. Visit movetoamend.org/interfaith-caucus for more information.
That's it for this edition of Move to Amend Reports. Thanks for listening and have a great week.
Move to Amend Reports was created and brought to you by Move to Amend. Produced by national team members Keon Bliss, Laura Bonham, Egberto Willis, Caitlin Saposi-Belknap, and Renee Babcock, with the assistance of Grace Novak, and with contributions from Move to Amend staff and affiliates. Opening theme entitled Move to Amend, performed by Shimako Noble and produced by Soul Circuitry.